Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Right now at Safeway, get your skin winter ready with big savings on all your favorite skincare products. Shop for deals on items like Gillette Mach 3 razors, Gillette Labs razors and blades, Venus razors and blades, and Native shampoo, conditioner, and body wash. Plus, shop the buy two, get one free baking event and save on items like selected varieties of Handy Foil and Good Cook pans. Offer expires December 26th. Restrictions apply. Promotions may vary. Visit Safeway.com for full offer details.
And I sang this one night just to my mother and my sister, I think. And I think I must have been like 12, 13. And my mother cried. And this made such a big impression on me that I realized that I was doing something that actually did something to others. I went to the studio for the first time in my life with my own songs with 15. And every time the musicians were a lot older than me. And every time they were saying, oh, you have no idea and you're just a schoolgirl, you don't know what you're doing and so on. And I very early on started to play with genders because there's one song on the first album called Boy on the Beach. And of course, the journalists, which were mainly men back then, they thought that I was singing to this or about this boy on the beach. And then I have a line where I say, woman by the river, can you taste my love? So they didn't get it that I was being the boy.
You're listening to Pop, the History Makers, with me, Steve Blame.
Katharina Frank. Welcome. It's really lovely to see you. I mean, really lovely to see you because, you know, you're also someone connected and of my past, let's say, and someone who I have good memories of. So this is great, and it's really lovely to see you. Now, you had in a sense, a privileged upbringing, and I don't mean financially, but I mean in a cultural sense. Because your upbringing, although you were born in Dusseldorf, I believe, your upbringing was in different countries. Can you tell me, first of all, how you came or how that came about?
My parents were very adventurous. My father, I was born in Dusseldorf, which is North Rhine-Westphalia, how you call it, and my father is also from there, and he wanted to worked for Thyssen, for a big German steel company, and he wanted to work in other countries. He had even some countries which I don't even know the names, or probably had different names back then than today, so I can't really say that. But then he had like the choice, the concrete choice between going to Turkey or going to Portugal. And he chose Portugal. I think Turkey was also that he was supposed to go without the family. And he wanted to take the family, my sister and my mother and me. So yeah, he chose Portugal. And this was shortly after I was born. Actually, we were there for a year in Portugal. I only know it because of some photographs, of course, and about some stories my parents told me. And then we came back to Düsseldorf, basically to pack up all the stuff. And I think when I was about 4 years old, we moved to Portugal for good. And then there was the revolution a couple of years later. And my father went to Brazil because the company wasn't, you know, it was problematic to get deals or whatever with the country in such a turmoil. So he changed workplace in the company with the steel company, went to Brazil. And after almost a year, the family followed. But especially my mother and my sister weren't too happy there for several different reasons. And so after 2 years, 2.5 years, we returned back to Portugal, which for me, it was nice. The only thing that wasn't too nice was that I had failed 1 year in school, and I was returning to my old school, and my classmates from like 2 years before, they were 1 year ahead of me. So this was a little frustrating, but the rest was okay. It's nice.
What languages were you brought up in?
German and Portuguese. I mean, because I was very small, I basically learned, of course, with 4 years I could speak, but I was not, you know, I wouldn't speak like a child or like a grown up person. So I basically learned to speak Portuguese and German more or less at the same time. And I didn't want to go to when we changed from Germany to Portugal, I didn't want to go to the child's school, to the kindergarten. My mother said okay, and I stayed at home with a lady who took care of us and who worked also for my parents, and I was spent a lot of time with her, and so I learned to speak Portuguese with her, basically.
You said that your father wanted to keep the family together, and that was one of the reasons why it, you know, it took a little while at the start. Were you brought up in a very sort of family atmosphere? Or, you know, with a father who obviously had to work very hard and you know, had a full-time job, or was he an absent father in any way?
Well, I would say he was an absent father because he did work very much. And but I think this was just also the whole thing about fathers and families back then, is that the man was going to bring in the money, and the man is going to make a career, and the woman, the wife, stays at home and takes care of the kids. I mean, the thing in Portugal was, we were not like, neither my mother or my father, there were no academics in the family. My sister then, yes, she went to university, but they were really working people. I mean, not working class, I wouldn't say that, but middle class or something like this. But they but it was also the time, you know, where you could move up in a company like Thyssen, especially when you're in the in a foreign country, because you can have the chance as a relatively young man to become like the director of that branch of the German big German company. And so this is what my father definitely wanted to achieve, and he did after a while. But therefore, he was not much at home. And when he came home, or when he was at home during weekends, he had to find, his daughters were being brought up very freely and were very independent at an early age. And so he basically had to fight for this daddy thing that we all have to sit at the table and eat breakfast together, or at least do some things together quite early on.
What was there some form of culture clash between your parents and the society that they had gone into in that way?
Definitely, because it was common, and also it was basically almost like you have to have this. Everybody had a maid, like a housemaid. And in our case, we had a housemaid, which she was very, very proud. I wrote a radio play dedicated to this, to Nazaré, whom I was brought up with and whom I learned Portuguese with. And she was a very, very strong character. And she lived in the house. She had her own room upstairs with all of us. And my parents definitely were not from a background where this was normal. So I have a scene in this radio play where I tell how when I was with my mother in the whatever living room, and she was like sitting with her legs up on the small table, and I said, "Hey, Nazaré is coming. Put your legs down." So it was like basically Nazaré was so used to working to like these huge families with lots of children and aunts and uncles and grandparents, and everybody's there, and maybe even with some how do you say, lord and lady background, you know, like these high class people. This is really funny because we didn't want to have like these huge tables set with many, many different types of forks and knives and stuff. And she had to really, size down with us. But I think we had a great time together.
Were you brought up in any form of cultural atmosphere? Because if I remember my childhood, it was really sort of pushed onto me that the most important thing would be to find a job to earn money. It was never about doing something culturally or what you wanted to do.
Well, I mean, we were lucky in this way because my mother, she, before the marriage and before having my sister and me, she was a Buchhändlerin. How do you say? She worked for a bookstore, but you really had to learn this. This is really quite a thing you have to learn. And there were lots of books around, and both my parents were extremely interested in music, all sorts of music. And of course, from my mother's side, there was a lot of jazz music and rock music. And from my father's side, it was more or Portuguese music, or, you know, Moroccan music, all sorts of things that they like to hear. So I was surrounded by lots of books and lots of music before I started to get into it myself. And then they were really into the country they went to. So it was not that we just sat around in our German community there or something. We had lots of Portuguese people around, and also, I mean, we were growing up in school, there were not just Portuguese people, there were French people, there were American people. It was a big mixture. And so in that case, I was quite lucky. But it was really when we came to Portugal, which was at the end of the 60s, it was still a country before the revolution. It was very, very conservative. It is, of course, also very Catholic. Back then it was, and many things were not normal. Like my mother and Nazaré, the woman I just talked about, they dare to go in places where they were not supposed to go and have a glass of wine, which women are not supposed to do, especially not if not accompanied by men. And many things were really, really like maybe in the 50s or even the 40s in other countries of Europe then. And
do you remember how that made you feel, knowing that your mother or the woman that looked after you, how that made you feel in terms of being a young woman and eventually being in that you know, could be in that position?
Well, it was, how do you say? I mean, my mother and Nazaré, I mean, of course, I was still small when they were experiencing all of that. But since we grew up And our parents left us a lot of freedom, gave us a lot of freedom. I think we made some experiences which maybe other girls in my age wouldn't have made. Also the way how you are perceived as a girl or a young woman in that days I was still a girl, I would say, but things that would happen in the street, how other young men or how men would talk to you. And so I had a sense of that it was not a totally safe space. But since I was still a child, I didn't even think about any of that, and got in some situations where also Nazaré came to help. And we were just playing in the parks and everywhere, and there were constantly some guys in the bushes or so waiting for us and even following us around. And so at one point, I remember how Nazaré came to pick us up because it was getting late or whatever, time for dinner. And she saw that we were being followed by guys, so she picked up a stone and threw it against them, and they ran away. But so this is a little bit the perception I had, and also of course going with public transport, it was sometimes it was different. But I didn't know any other. I mean, I just know the difference between what my mother would say or what my father would say, or how they moved about. I mean, even in Brazil, I remember I was small. I was still a child. And I remember feeling it unfair to not be able to walk alone to the places and just walk around in the cities or go to a cafe or do something. I thought, why can't I do this? Why do the men or the boys can do it and I have to stay away? So this was more the sense that I had. Later on, of course, I was more, I wouldn't shut up, you know, if somebody would call me names or whatever, I'd rather get into a fight than to just let it happen.
Did you sing as a small child?
I sang, I sang lullabies. I mean, my mother used to sing lullabies to me. She had a very nice and soft and beautiful voice. And I sang sometimes to myself also to help me fall asleep.
But did you perform for the family at all?
I did perform. I think one performance for my family was basically the reason why I decided that I wanted to become a touring musician, that I wanted to play for people. And this was when we were already in Brazil, and I started learning to play the guitar, and the guitar, the teacher, he was quite smart. He realized very quickly that I wanted to be able to accompany myself on the guitar, that I didn't want to do any finger picking and licks and whatever, but I wanted to just have something to sing to. And so I learned lots of songs with him. And there was one song, Maria Ninguém, which many people have sung. Even Brigitte Bardot has sung that. And I sang this one night just to my mother and my sister, I think. And I think I must have been like 12, 13. And my mother cried. And this made such a big impression on me that I realized that I was doing something that actually did something to others. I couldn't really, you know, it's like a mother crying is not something that as a child you put away like that. It leaves an impression. And so this is, I think this was like one of the reasons. And on the other hand, also in Brazil, since my parents were new there and they were getting into the life, they took us with them before we started school. And we went to a place which is called a sambão, which is where people go for dinner. And so it's huge places, and they have a stage and a band playing all the time with interpreters coming around and changing interpreters. And so first you eat, and then at some point all the tables are pushed aside and people start dancing. And so we were on something like that. And my father and I, or just my father, I don't know, got to talk to the musicians. He played a little bit of guitar too. So he talked to the musicians and I talked to them. And then I was allowed to visit the band in their rehearsal room. I don't remember how and when. I just remember that I spent a whole day listening to them rehearsing. I didn't sing. I didn't do anything. I just sat there and I felt like this is my place. This is what I want to do. I want to have a rehearsal room. I want to make music all day. And then I want to go out and play for people. So, yeah, this was how it started.
When I was a teenager, 13, in 1972, Bowie came up, and Bowie represented, even more than his music, he represented a world where I thought that I could belong. As a gay teenager, that for me was a world that I felt I could be comfortable in instead of the world of my parents. Was there an artist, for whatever reason, I mean, I know you're a lesbian and it could be the same reason, but that represented a world where you thought you could belong?
I don't really know if that's what I thought, but I mean, I remember that before or at the same time or sometime later, I don't know, the energy and the, let's say, audacity of somebody like Patti Smith, in this sense, who was also, she also said she's not a trained musician. She had a lot to say, and in normal pop music or something, you wouldn't use so many words, and you wouldn't put so much energy in one thing. And on the other side, there was Janis Joplin, who was just somebody who erupted on stage, and where you knew this is where she feels the best or the realest. So I think these people are people who are like the drummer from The Who, you know, Keith Moon, people who just kind of, where you could feel this is how they come to life when they go on stage and when they perform and when they play their instrument. And this is where they also fight their fights. I mean, it's not just beautiful. It's not just about message. It's a message, but it's also a, how do you say, a fight with oneself. You know, you're actually trying to understand what's going on with yourself, what's going on inside of you. And sometimes it's more than words can say. So this has to come out. And so maybe on that side, Janis Joplin was even more important to me than Patti Smith, who had a different function. I think she was somebody who, due to the fact that she was coming also from literature and from poetry and from all these things, which of course there was the connection at my home with books and music, she appealed on that side. But the mere thing of, if I want to survive, if I want to breathe normally, I have to become a singer and a performer. So that was maybe Janis Joplin then.
I mean, talking about Patti Smith and Janis Joplin, and I mean, I'm a screenwriter today, and I go into my past and the wounds in my past, and to be able to write. So I don't necessarily write directly from my past, but it's a fictional subject. But the pain I sort of bring out, and that makes it real. So when, if you're saying that these are the people that really inspired you, I mean, for me, that's where they were getting, you know, their inspiration was from their dark sort of pain inside.
Yeah.
When do you think then you first realized that you could feed into this pain within you to create?
I think I felt, because I felt also on, I mean, first, of course, you have to create as a pop musician or rock musician, and then you go on stage, or then you play for your friends or for people. So first you have to go in the songwriting and in this quite lonely creation. Or before you start working with a band, you just have to write your own songs. So this was something which I would say was a very, very concentrated act, and which was, I was actually, I don't know if I can really explain this, but it was actually something which I could do in my own little room, and I wouldn't just think about, I mean, back then it was a lot easier than today, what was happening all around the world. So I could basically concentrate on the only thing that was in me by writing it down or by playing the guitar for hours and singing words that would come up. But I think I lost my track.
It was about the pain inside and how that and how you feed on that.
Yeah, but this is very, very concentrated, and I was free from whatever could have been said or whatever has been said before, or what, you know, free from any comments, free from any how do you call it, if you give something, or two, five stars, or is it just one star, or do I put the thumb down? Okay, we didn't have all these things back then, but you know, like other people's opinion. And then on stage you normally would say, okay, now she goes on stage and she exposes herself to all these people who can watch her, maybe sneer or also applaud. But the thing is that when I'm performing on stage, and even today, I can get into a position where I'm kind of outside of my body. So whatever I felt, and as a girl, as a young woman, and also as an older woman now, there's lots of body issues. And I mean, back then they were even worse, because you wouldn't even in the public eye, in social or in videos or whatever, you wouldn't see like a woman that didn't look just absolutely heavenly. You wouldn't see like a normal looking woman. You wouldn't see a person who doesn't claim any gender. You wouldn't see all these things. So it was basically, you had to be so strong to go up on stage and say, I don't care. I'm not just this thing. I'm much more. And if I have something to say, if I'm well prepared to show this to the people, I will be able to just leave it all behind and not disembody, but be free, you know, free and light from all the pressure and all the thinking. And so this is really what I always try to achieve. And when I'm working and it's really working out well, I forget about everything. And I don't care, even if the outcome, there are no rules. I don't have like this thing that I want to achieve. I just want to do it. And the same thing happens, if it's a good day, happens on stage too. So basically, yeah, I want to be free from myself. I don't want to encounter myself and all the things that I do to myself, which basically I've absorbed over the years, which I have experienced. I mean, this is how you grow up. You learn so many things, which are not always the nicest things to learn. I mean, some people are lucky and they don't have that, but sooner or later you get to a place where you will, you know, just something will happen which makes you either go another way, turn back, but you have to fight it. But first, of course, you also have to understand it. So basically all my working is I'm trying to understand what's happening and what happened and what's my part and what did I pick up on the way.
When you came back to Germany from Portugal, were you treated, and I don't mean in terms of German society, but this would happen anywhere, the way you come back to, were you treated more like an outsider because your experience had been different?
I wouldn't say that. To be honest, I enjoyed it. You know, if I could, I mean, even today, although I'm in Germany for so many years, I enjoyed telling people that I don't know their TV shows, and I don't know maybe even the songs that they listened to when they grew up. That I was happy, and I didn't feel like an outsider. I didn't feel, I mean, the main difference was that all the people that I met then, all the new people that I was meeting, they had like a family background there, a bigger family background than I. They had their childhood friends and their school friends and their new acquaintances. And I really didn't have that. I didn't have any memories to which everybody could relate to. But I was so fixated on music. And since I took the freedom, I took myself the freedom to do this mainly. I mean, at some point I started doing jobs, odd jobs to earn some money, but this was what I was doing. So the connection between the people and I, or the people I was meeting, I was always music and working together, or, you know, just creating something.
What was the trigger for you to go to Berlin?
Well, Berlin was already, I was almost 3 years in Germany when I moved to Berlin. And this was because I had in Hamburg, I had met some musicians who told me, if you want to start something, you have to go to Berlin. So I went to Berlin.
Well, actually, I mean, it's interesting because Berlin was, in a sense, the center of the world at that point because of the Cold War. It was, you know, physically seen as well, it was the place where the bomb was going to go off first, probably. So it was in that sense, the center of the world. It was also a very different place back then than it is today. And it was a very unique place in the world. For people who don't know, could you explain what the uniqueness of Berlin was and how you experienced it at first when you got there?
Well, of course, the uniqueness was mainly that it was like an island in a different country, and with the wall and of course there was how did I experience this? I mean, it was, I don't know how it is today. If young people come to Berlin today, I hear it's also very tough and hard, but that was really tough and hard because it was the early 80s. It was really still a torn city. There were streets where you could see it was still war torn. There was a lot of blank spaces, but there was a lot of spaces which were, there was no houses at all, where you could see there had been standing houses, so not ruins because they had taken it all down, but you could see, and there was it was quite poor, I would say. It was not a rich city. It was
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
It was really still ragged. I don't know how to to explain it.
But there was a community of I sort of say that in a sort of wider sense. There was a community of musicians who would swap and, you know, they would switch and swap with each other in each other's bands. They would work together and then work with someone else. So, you know, Berlin is always talked about in these terms of having this sort of group of people. But were you in that or were you an outsider? Okay.
No, I was not at all in that. I mean, it might have existed, but I didn't see that. I mean, the thing is that the musicians I had met in Hamburg, they were still living at home. So they were living like a very, in some ways, quite secure place under the roof of their parents' house. And I was sharing a two-bedroom apartment in Kreuzberg, which was back then really nothing like the Kreuzberg you know today. It was not so gentrified, and of course lots of Turkish people living there, and lots of students, lots of people who didn't have any money, and lots of also punks and lots of drugs, lots of stuff like that, but not in the high class way, not the coke thing, but the heroin and the dirty drugs kind of things. So I was kind of in two worlds. I would go to Zehlendorf to work with my friends or colleagues who had met at the music school in Hamburg, and then I returned home and I started working at the supermarket and at places like that to make money. And it was like two worlds. And so when I went home, I stayed there on my own, working with my little, first I didn't have even a 4-track cassette recorder. I just had like a cassette player with two players. And then I was just doing my stuff then. And then I would go and earn some money. And then I would go to the movies. And then I would go back home again. And
it sounds very, were you isolated? Was it just you?
It was mainly just me, because I never studied, I never went to university, so, and I never went to any sort of grown-up school, and the people I knew then they were all studying at the university, so they had something to do during the day or so, and I was isolated in a sense that I had maybe more freedom, but of course I also, I was alone. There was not so many people to talk to and to exchange maybe thoughts, who had nothing to do with music or with making music or with a great song that you've heard on the radio or something. So it was for some time. And then of course, when I started to sing in other people's bands, the main contact was during rehearsals and during singing in other people's bands. And there was not such a friendly exchange in a way. So there was a time where I also thought, maybe, you know, something's wrong with you. And I was not sure if I was I was doing everything right. But I saw then a woman doctor, because I thought maybe I also had a lot of headaches and stuff, and I thought maybe something wrong with me. But she told me, first of all, to eat better and to sleep more and to go and meet some people and not be on my own too much. So basically like that.
You're listening to Pop, The History Makers, with me, Steve Blame.
I mean, it sounds like that music was really your friend from the beginning, that it was something that was a constant with you. And maybe also, you know, people always talk about creative compensation through music, and therefore it was something that accompanied you the whole time. How did Rainbirds eventually come into being?
I was singing in a band called Les Black Carnations, which was a band where the main songwriter was very much a lover, and still is a lover of 60s beat music and, you know, the Velvet Underground and all sorts of bands like that. And I started singing in that band, I think in 85. And we played a lot of shows. We also had lots of, we played on the radio, on Radio For You, it was called back then. And there were, SF Beat, which even before Radio For You. And we even played a couple of live shows, which were recorded then. So, and we did small tours. And I was already writing my own songs. So I tried to convince the songwriter to have some of my songs in the repertoire too, but he didn't want to. So when the whole band thing was starting to get a little shaky, and I think the guitarist wanted to concentrate on his other band and the drummer was moving away to Munich, I basically took the chance and also left the band and decided to retreat, basically, because I had been singing in quite a few bands, and work on my own, continue to work on my own. And then when, if I have like a sum of songs that I wanted to play to some people, maybe I could start from scratch with my own songs. And that was the time when Vince Clarke made Yazoo, and I was such a big fan, and I thought, so maybe if it's such a always the same thing with the bands and they don't want to play my song, so maybe if I find just one person who wants to work with me on my songs, and then we do something like Yazoo, and we wouldn't need any musicians, we just work the two of us. I met one of those guys. But he was on another trip. He wasn't keen on doing anything like that. And he told me, so why don't you contact that and this musician? And then they might even other people, and then you can go and find your own band. So basically, this is what I've done. I contacted the bass player from Rainbirds, Beckmann. I played him my songs. I contacted the drummer, Wolfgang. I played him my songs, and I had them on cassette. And we contacted a guitarist who was a lot older than us. Who didn't stick on, didn't stay all the time, but in the first year he was playing with us, and did a nice guitar stuff, which even made it onto the first album, and but we also had a keyboarder, and we had another singer and a background vocalist, and so we even tried something with brass, with saxophones and trumpets, and we did a lot of experimentation. So we just worked a lot. We played a lot together, and then in the end, as a quintet, a woman keyboarder with backing vocals, and Wolfgang Beckmann, the guitarist, who was called Glenn. I'm sorry to say that. What was his last name? Well, doesn't matter. I hope he doesn't see this. We played our first gig in Villa Kreuzberg, which was a place where many, many up and coming or young bands who were just starting could perform whole shows, like double bills or three people on the bill or something like that. And shortly before that, I also had played a couple of solo gigs, where I was basically, even before playing the first gig with Rainbirds, we weren't called that yet. We were called it, but then there was some confusion with the first person who I came in contact with, who then contacted the business. Well, who kind of, I could say, how do you say, I don't know, the word is missing. If you break somebody, if you find somebody and bring it to the big big.
So like an A&R, someone
yeah.
Okay.
You know, and he saw me on my own, playing on my own, and was very impressed. So basically, I first had to tell everybody, yeah, but I have a band and I really want to do this with the band. So they came to see us.
Can I just ask you there? Because, you know, the music business is a business. And if you're a musician and really into music, a lot of people can be, and I completely understand it. And even in, you know, what was my past business, you can be extremely naive and come in and not really understand the repercussions of the business later on. You were the person that came in with the songs. You were Rainbirds in many ways. When you look back, do you see that naivety? And I just wondered, what was the impact of that?
Well, the naivety was, of course, very big. But for some reason I had, and I was very blue-eyed. I think even today I've been reading some books, of course, since then, about the business and about music managers and A&Rs and people who, yeah. So I know the machinery behind any band is that is being seen or can be seen and heard is very big. So back then, for me, this was still like a group of friends. Everybody who said, oh, you're great, we're going to be working with you, where I considered them as very positively thinking and very helpful. And I was very happy, very thankful even that they wanted to work with me and wanted to work first the musicians that they wanted to work with me, then the next guys that wanted to work with the whole band. So this was my whole thing, that basically I was open to everything, and I was also wanting to give everybody everything I had to give. So and in that sense, I was on the other hand quite lucky that I had one determination, because I had started with writing my own songs with 13, 14. I went to the studio for the first time in my life with my own songs with 15. And every time the musicians were a lot older than me. And every time they were saying, oh, you have no idea and you're just a schoolgirl, you don't know what you're doing, and so on. So there was one thing that was, I could, even if I would have been totally soft one day, I would say this, this is a band that will play my songs. I won't be doing any tra-la-la on top of anybody's playbacks. So I will write the songs. I will come with the songs to the rehearsal place or to the studio, and then we start working on it together. So this was really, I'm very clear about that. I was also very clear about the lyrics that I didn't think that the lyrics are less worth than the music, which was at some point there was a discussion about that. And then I had help on another thing, is because I wanted the band to be called Rainbirds. And it was very important for me that the band is not the Rainbirds, it's just Rainbirds, in a sense that these Rainbirds are the Rainbirds of today. And they might stay that way for some time, but they might also change. So it's never going to be the Rainbirds. It's going to be always a flock of Rainbirds with new ones and coming in and other ones leaving and returning. So this was really my idea of a band. And so the first manager we had, which was Thomas Fehlmann, I'm sure you know him, he told me that let's make like this head of agreements before anything happens and put down those three points. And so on this sense, I was safe, basically. And and also, I mean, we were lucky. We had the, I think, one of the most unusual label bosses working for Universal, or back then it was called Phonogram in Germany, who after the unexpected success of our debut album changed our contracts. I mean, he could have just earned like triple of what he had he was earning with us, but if he didn't have changed the contract. But he was just a cool guy. He thought, okay, we made this contract with a band. We didn't know if they were going to make any money, if all the expenses we had will ever come back. And so even before we played our first tour, it was clear that they were going to have a big revenue. And so he was kind enough to change it and have us get at least something.
How did the song Blueprint come about?
The song Blueprint came about, I was living in a very small, in a one-room apartment, one room, a very tiny kitchen and of course, a bathroom bathroom, shower and toilet. And I didn't have much stuff. Everything I had went into the music. Every money I earned, everything went into music. I didn't have a lot of stuff to wear. I didn't have lots of things. I just had a mattress on the floor and I think maybe a little table and a chair or something like this in the kitchen. And so I played my guitar and sitting on that mattress, and this is how Blueprint came about. I don't remember how the words came to me. Blueprint, to be honest, is a song that I think even today, I mean it's been more than 30 years, so I know what Blueprint is about, but I don't think I totally knew what Blueprint was about then. It was about imagining something, about, in this case, imagining the kind of person you want to be and with whom you want to be, your lover, and that you can do this, you know, you can kind of make up your mind what kind of person you are looking for and who do you want to be with, but you cannot or you should not think that this is going to be your life forever. You shouldn't stick your dreaming and your thinking onto just one image, basically. You shouldn't do that. You should be aware that things are probably not going to turn out how you imagined. And so this is basically what Blueprint was about, or what I would say today, what Blueprint was about. I don't remember what I thought back then. I just thought it was very empowering. I mean, it was very freeing. And I felt, and it felt very freeing to me to sing these words. And today I know that for better or for worse, the song is still a very big song. It's still being played a lot on radio every time, and it's definitely my most successful song. And in some way, I'm still in there. I'm still doing the same stuff. I'm still living that life. And I'm turning 60 this year. So I'm, in a way, I'm trying to free myself, not to free myself of Blueprint or of the whole story of that, but to just I don't know, not to do what I told the people not to do, is to really get rid of all the expectations and get rid of all the formats and stuff. I mean, my whole working career was trying to break through formats and trying to play a new trick on myself to not stay at the same position and so on. And maybe I just want for now to do this without maybe not so much thinking and not so much hard work, but just, you know, maybe actually go back to how I started. I just want to play music and forget about all the rest. And it's a good time.
Many many artists of, I'm going to say our generation, I'm 4 years older, so don't worry about 60, that's young. many artists of our age, because their success, first successes are like 30 years ago, they're going through their back catalogue and looking at things and re-releasing and revisiting the past, which is a really interesting thing to do, and it can be tough as well. It doesn't necessarily need to be easy. I just wondered what you're finding out about yourself by revisiting and looking at the past, and maybe also listening to material that wasn't released back then, and discovering things about yourself.
Well, it's a little bittersweet, to say the least, what I'm discovering, because now I'm actually, I wanted to, last year I booked myself a tour for November of last year, and I had another small tour in the summer with another project, and of course it was still a little difficult because of Corona. Everybody was having COVID at some point or the other. Some musicians were ill, and also I got COVID myself, and I wanted to really go back on tour. I wanted to basically celebrate all the stuff that I had made. I mean, not just the newest songs, with an addition of Sea of Time and Blueprint, and maybe one or two songs from the second Rainbirds album, but really from the whole catalog, including my solo albums and whatever. And it was so that basically my health or my body told me, you can't do it. I mean, I got to a point where I just had to cancel everything, and since then I haven't played live. I'm still kind of recovering. My cold has nothing to do with it. It's just something out there, and but that was really a moment where I thought, you know, I this is what I want to do for real, but I think I need to take a break before I do it, because I have been working too hard. I mean, I had working too hard, meaning I have been doing too much effort for something that I dream of should be or could finally become effortless. And I find out that really, due to the extreme success of the big success I had in my early days, that for some reason there was this big misunderstanding that doing what I do is hard work. I mean, I don't mean it in a sense that I want to be like writing songs like that, pouring out, because this is never going to happen. Everybody knows writing a good song, a song with a deeper meaning or with like multiple lives, is nothing that you do very easily. I mean, you can have like those novelty songs, which every band has one of these songs which become extremely successful, and the band always said, oh my God, why did this song become so successful? It doesn't mean anything. It's just, we're just having fun in the bathtub or something like that. And then it's this huge hit. But trying to find something like this without being a novelty song, but a really song with a meaning, is really hard work. And for me, this is nothing I'm afraid of, but all the everything else, the organization and the managing and the planning and the timetables and this and this, become over the years harder and harder and harder for me, because of course my later albums, I mean, when I became a solo artist, I didn't have that big of a success that you had like people lining up wanting to help me. I really had to ask, now I have this new project, I have this new album, do you want to do this with me? And so it was always, I always returned back to the beginning again. And I came to a point where I said, I don't want to do this anymore. I don't want to go all the way back because I failed maybe to write this next blueprint, or because I failed to stick to the same system, because I'm not this type of artist who repeats herself all the time. So really, what I want to do for the future is to really celebrate the music, not just my own stuff, also celebrate other people's songs, fill them with whatever I have to give, and take from them whatever they give me, and not not have so much trouble in trying like the next to find like the next ring record label and the next management or the next tour agency. I mean, just enjoy myself. And this is the bittersweet thing. I can still, after so many years, say that I really want to do that. And the this is the sweet part, and the bitter part is that it comes from a very late knowledge with that my body taught me that you can't go on that way. I mean, too many things. The body has the strongest memory. Everything that happened in the past, things that have been said, things you have to fight for, it's all inside your body. And I think after a certain age, when you kind of slowly step into a situation that you already experienced before, your body says, no way, you're not going to go down that road again. This doesn't. And unfortunately, my body had to tell it to me the hard way. So I couldn't play the guitar anymore. I still have cramps sometimes, though I singing and feeling all cramped up is not such a good thing. So I'm on my way of shaking myself free, basically, to maybe next year or in 2 years to enjoy some more touring and live performing and so on.
One thing I can recommend, I do trauma therapy, which is, I mean, trauma can mean lots of things, but it's trauma from the past and how it affects your body.
Yeah.
And it really is a fascinating form of therapy, and in a sense, owning things that have happened to you within your past. In terms of identity, if I walk down the street and people of a certain age, a lot older now, people of a certain age may recognize me, I'm still MTV. For me, I have nothing to do with MTV at all in my life. I love interviewing people, and this is something that has always been of interest to me. But I see myself much more as a screenwriter and someone who's in isolation, creative, I would say. Yeah. And that's how I would more define myself. When you have something that is a very big past and a very successful past, how do you look at success today? What does success actually really mean to you?
Sorry. Success at the moment basically means to be successfully writing new songs, or successfully finishing a poem, or writing a short story or something. But to be honest, I think this was always I always considered this being the success. In the sense of commercial success, or success of an audience who loves you, who comes to your shows, who pays the tickets, who comes to your shows, who follows you around or buys your albums. This is also something that gives you the possibility and the capability to continue having the success of being a writer and a poet and a creator of things which, on the first level, don't seem to be something that the world needs. You know, I mean, I cannot sit down and say, today I'm going to write another song which everybody's been waiting for. And it's just that at the end of the day, if I wrote a song or a lyric and I think this is really good, I want to shout it out from the rooftop, or tell everybody that I did this, and that's success. And I mean, on the other hand, you know, with social media, you could do that. Some people do it every day. I'm too of a perfectionist to be doing that, like put out snippets of something new that I'm working on, because I want the people to hear the finished version, which I'm going to listen to for the next month on heavy rotation, because I love it so much. So that's why I don't put out constantly some small little things, and I prefer it that way. I don't miss this, to have this capability of putting out so much all the time. But also, that's also, I think, a generational thing. I mean, we have, I would, if somebody from, like, for instance, a concert, like somebody who wants to play, who wants me to play on in his club, and they ask me to make a short film and put it on social media telling people to come by, I always have to tell them I'm not going to do this, because this will at least take 2 days until I'm satisfied with the little 1 minute or 3 minute things that I've done there. And so I'll give you everything I have. I have photographs, I have a video, I have this, you can do with it what you want, but I'm not going to spend my day trying to make something that I'm happy with, you know. So I'd rather be, you know, making cut-ups and stuff, and hope that between the lines there is the new lyric that I'm going to sing, instead of trying to make a nice video for. I don't know. I know it's not very it's not, how do you say, top of the. How people should work, or people mostly work today. But this is also because I continue. I don't have like this staff around me that I call up and say, hey, come on, put up the cameras and let's do it. Well, I'm more of an enigma than working in the shadow.
I want to end with a question that I hope this is okay, because it's a generational thing. If we were young today and we were starting out, no one would give a shit that I'm a gay man and you're a lesbian. No one would even think about it. It wouldn't be the identity that we would get in public. When I was on MTV, they had a problem about me being gay. But on the other side, I didn't want to be defined as gay, because I felt I'm a TV presenter, but I'm not a gay TV presenter. Do you see what I mean? Then the difference.
Yeah.
How was it for you back then, and how aware were you of actually sort of holding on to your own identity and owning it, rather than that, than giving it away, in a sense?
Well, it was also a tricky situation, because I never before with Rainbow, with the first Rainbirds lineup, I was in no relationship, and I had no idea what I was, and I didn't really care. It was not my main issue to find out if I like girls or boys or whatever, or if I like anybody at all. If I just want to sing my songs. But of course, I started writing my songs, and I started exploring also my own feelings and visions, or what I thought was important. And I very early on started to play with genders, because there's one song on the first album called Boy on the Beach, and of course the journalists, which were mainly men back then, they thought that I was singing to this, or about this boy on the beach, and then I have a line where I say, woman by the river, can you taste my love? So they didn't get it that I was being the boy. And I was imploring this woman. And on the second Rainbirds album, there was a song, Jesus First. I'm not a Christian person, but I wrote it because I'd seen a TV thing about a woman who went into rehab because of, I think, drinking, heavy drinking. And she went into a very religious, very Catholic rehab center, and they were telling her, she was a lesbian, they were telling her that part of her problem were her gayness, and so she was talking about how that she would feel good and happy to be helped by these people, but on the other side, she was being asked to deny who she was. And so at the same time, there was, like, I think back then there was talk about that Whitney Houston was gay, and I was a big Whitney Houston fan, of course. And so Jesus First is basically me and I and Whitney Houston getting into a threesome with Jesus, you know, because, you know, we knew we were doing something which was not well seen, but we couldn't stop doing it. We said, so let's invite Jesus in and have a happy threesome. And nobody asked me about the song. Nobody wanted to know. And nowadays, I think they really, by not talking to me about it, they were just hiding it. They were just putting it under the covers or whatever, so they didn't have to talk about this fact that I was telling a happy gay story. And it was really, it's still a happy song. I mean, I love this song. But only when the first line, when I broke up the first lineup to continue as a duo with Ulrike Hage, and we became also partners, which was not told anybody. I mean, the management knew, and everybody was like, don't necessarily tell it to everybody. And I said, okay, I'm not going to hide it, but I'm not going to promote it. So, and also Ulrike Hage back then, she didn't feel the want or the need to promote it in any way. And so we'd never talked about it. But in a sense, there was this big time that I think Stern magazine had a newspaper, like the front cover of people who were outing themselves. And the fourth Rainbirds album was about to come out. And we had something like a shit storm with our third Rainbirds album, because it was not the boys and me, it was two women working together. And so even before the music came out, we had very bad reviews and people bad mouthing it and whatever. So what we really wanted to was to have our new album be perceived as an album of two musicians who evolved even further, who stick to their love for music. And so we didn't want to be on that cover. We said, no, we don't, we want to promote our new album as musicians and not as a freshly outed couple that makes music together. So I got so many bad letters from fans who were, or former fans who were disappointed. I understand their disappointment, but I wanted them to understand me too. You know, I thought, come on, this is double, triple hard to try to be perceived as a great musician, as a great lyricist, as a good singer, and to have a standing as a woman in a business which was still very much dominated by male musicians and by the male record companies and so on. So give me a break, let me just, you know, stick to that. But there were some disappointment there on this side, and for some time I wasn't really invited back into the gay icon type of thing, but I think it changed with the years and with some new, more explicit songs that I wrote later on in German. I was kind of I think it was okay. I came to terms with the fact that I didn't went with a banner, and you know that I that my banner was music and not the rainbow flag.
Yeah, well, it took MTV 5 years to get used to me as a gay man, and then they found out that I was fairly popular, and they came to me and said, "Would I present a gay music show?" I just went, "What am I going to play? I Will Survive for the rest of my life. Yeah. What am I going to do?"
Yeah, this was also the thing that they that I was then many times just we were, and then later on I invited on like some. The Teddy Awards, you know, things which were gay, connected to the gay scene. But yeah, then I just it was okay, because okay, then I did, it wasn't even an issue anymore. But in that time when it was so difficult to really be heard, just plainly because you are a musician, you're making your work, I was not willing to give that up. So at the same time, but
it's completely understandable. It's been wonderful talking to you. I'm sorry I didn't cover, you know, all your career, but I really wanted to talk about the early years, because particularly about what made you into you is always in incredibly fascinating. I think you've had a really fascinating life. I hope that in a couple of years or a year and a half you're back on tour and you feel well enough and confident enough to go out there and tour again. And I hope you also find out many more things about yourself by looking back through the past, because I think that's a really important thing to do of people, I'm going to say, of our age, because it is something that I think is about self-development and change and being comfortable with yourself and finding things out. And being present in the world, which is great. And
I mean, the fact is, I really do have to go back also into my albums, because finally, after some time, I have a great new contact to the back catalog, Thomas Thyssen from Universal, and I told him you forgot to release the third Rainbirds album. It's not available digital. And so there will be a release finally, digitally, of Two Faces. So I will be doing some stuff also for Two Faces. And then there are quite a few jubilees happening. Right now it's 35 years of debut album and Blueprint. And then next year there will be the second album, which has some very beloved songs. I mean, they're not as big as Blueprint, but there's a big audience, especially for Sea of Time or Love is a Better Word or songs like that. And so we are working closely together to really celebrate the back catalog of Rainbirds. And I have a couple of two more Rainbirds albums that I'm going to re-release from the 90s. And so there's lots of stuff coming, and it's a good way to see, to look back and to see what have I done and what else is there to do. And I'm also I'm happy. I'm trying to, you know, ask people to invite me, to ask me, do you want to do something with me? Do you want to work with me? Or let's celebrate another musician together. It's all about celebration.
Well, that's brilliant. Thank you so much. I really enjoyed it, Katharina. And I wish you all the success in the future, and I hope to see you again at one point.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Steve. It was great to see you.
I know fitness is important, but I don't have time to keep up with all the fads and celebrity workouts that come and go. I need something backed by real science that will get real results and fits into my schedule. Caliber has been a lifesaver. It's a science-based fitness coaching program covering strength, nutrition, and healthy habits, completely customized to my needs and abilities. All I did was fill out their online assessment, and Caliber did the rest. The best part is, I'm not in it alone. Caliber paired me with an expert personal trainer who checks on my progress and keeps me motivated and on track. And I'm not the only one getting results. Caliber is top rated on Trustpilot with 4.9 out of 5 stars. On average, members achieve a 20% or better improvement in their body composition by week 12 of the program. Start a science-based fitness program you'll actually stick with. Get $100 off at CaliberStrong.com/podcast. That's CaliberStrong.com/podcast.
We made USAA insurance for veterans like James. When he found out how much USAA was helping members save, he said,
"It's time to switch."
We'll help you find the right coverage at the right price. USAA. What you're made of, we're made for. Restrictions apply.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Kayla Itzinas.
I'm Kayla Itzinas, and I have been training a global community of women since 2009. I've created a brand new podcast, Sweat Daily, to help you level up your life and reach your health and well-being goals. From fitness tips to food that fuels you, meditation to motivation, we've got you covered. Sweat Daily, the happiest, healthiest, and most confident version of you awaits. Available on Apple Podcasts and wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.